The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
Start by a lift. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wiggison. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wiggison.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program, and I'm David Livingston, your host. Great to be here. Great to be here live, and actually great to be alive, too. And we welcome you for a great program. I'll tell you more about it in just a minute. We're on the 60-minute format today, so do pay attention to your clocks, your watches, and if you want to get an email in for our guest or call us, please make sure you do it while we're still on the air. I say that all the time, but you'd be surprised how many emails and phone calls come in for the guest and the show after the show has ended. So, we're on the 60-minute format. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223, and our email is drspace@thespaceshow.com. All of our newsletters are published. The email one goes out at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning, Monday morning, California time. If you want to be on that distribution list, make sure I have your email address, and I will add you to it. All of this is also updated and posted on our website, thespaceshow.com. A couple of other quick announcements. We have a full week of programming. We're back to a regular week, except John Batchelor is traveling, so there will be no Hotel Mars this coming week. There was supposed to be Hotel Mars last week with a fabulous story about an asteroid that hit in the biblical area of Sodom and Gomorrah and is thought to be the root of that story. And it's about the archaeologists and what they found, and the asteroid remnants and the chemicals in the sand, and he didn't have an acceptable phone line. As try as John Batchelor could, even with CBS help, he could not make Hit Sky's cell phone number work. So hopefully we will find a way around that so we can bring you this story either on Hotel Mars or on the Space Show in the near future. But it's an exciting story, and it's being written up in all the archaeological papers and journals, and it's a for real article. So, doing a regular space show today. So, a couple of other things before I introduce our guests. Don't forget to check the upper left menu, because that tells you how to listen to live programs, podcasts, and archives off of our website under the Listen Live menu. And also, we are a listener supported 501c3 nonprofit space show program, meaning you, the listener, your support is what keeps us going, and we certainly appreciate your support and need it. PayPal is the easiest way to support us. We have a very large PayPal button at the top of our homepage. For people who are more old school and would like to send us a check, our nonprofit is One Giant Leap Foundation, and it mails to Box 95, Tiburon, T-I-B-U-R-O-N, California, 94920. And if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax donation for your gift. For sure, if you're a California taxpayer, you get a state deduction. And then, depending on whether your state accepts tax-free status from other states, you may or may not get a tax deduction in your own state. Our nonprofit website is onegiantleapfoundation.org, or if you have questions, you can always email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. For today, we have returning guest Emily Carney, and I'm very glad she's back. She blogs now with the National Space Society, and I've been reading several of her articles that caught my attention. Their general title is Space in the 70s, and then each one sort of highlights an element of the time period she is writing about. We'll cover that. We'll cover some of her other articles and more. But she has been a spaceflight enthusiast and an author. She served in the nuclear U.S. Navy, and she was not blogging with NSS when I first met her a couple of years ago, but she has added that to her list of where she is available, which is in multiple places on the Internet. Her full bio is available on our website, so you can read about her and access her work in many places. And again, since this is a 60-minute program, we certainly want to talk to her more than we want to talk about her. But do also remember we take sponsors, and we love our sponsors. They are Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, and the National Space Society. Read their banner ads. Become a sponsor yourself if you're interested. Email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And remember, on the longer shows, I read a full sponsor message. On the 60-minute program, we just shout out to our great sponsors, as we just did. So with that, we turn over to Emily. And Emily, welcome back to the Space Show. How have you been?
I'm doing great. I hope I sound okay.
Yeah, you sound better than me. My voice is still not recovered from surgery, and I'm pushing 2 weeks for that. It still is cracking from all the crap they put down my throat without my knowledge. But well, I guess I had my knowledge because I agreed to the surgery. So, are you still in Florida, or did you relocate?
I still live in St. Petersburg, Florida. I'm still in the same place, and I'm doing well. I'm very busy nowadays, which is pretty good. So I'm doing great.
How did you get picked up for blogging with the National Space Society?
That's a great question. Basically, what happened was for years, I think for 8 or 9 years, I published on Blogger, which is, I think, through Google. And it was just an independent blog, and
right.
I got a lot of traffic, but still I was looking for, like, an outlet, like a larger outlet to carry the blog through, like a, you know, maybe like a website or like a space website or a science website or something like that. Just sort of, you know, so mutually, you know, they could get my readers and I could get their readers, that type of thing. So I really wanted to do something like that. So I was looking at a few places that, you know, that may have been interested, you know. And I contacted the NSS, and I'm a member of the NSS, and I have a good relationship with them. And I was like, you know, hey, is there any way you'd want to run, you know, run my blog on your you know, your all's is, you guys' blog wall, you know?
Right.
And they thought about it, and they said yes to it. So about a little over 2 years ago, I started running this space available on the NSS's blog, and it's really been awesome. I'm very proud to be part of their heritage. I am a member of the NSS for quite some time, and I've also written articles for their magazine, Ad Astra, as well. But I'm really proud to be part of it just because the NSS just has such a rich heritage, you know, going back to the 70s, you know, and I think they've done so much, and I'm very proud to be a part of that. Part of it, too, is because I thought, you know, they have a name in the space community. They're, you know, they have prestige, you know, and that's something, you know, I wanted to be, I guess, associated with something like that and a part of that. So a part of that, their unique heritage. So, yeah, so that's basically what happened, and I've had a pretty good working relationship with them, and I'm really excited to, I'm really excited to do things with them in the future as well.
Well, I also have had a long heritage with them even before I was doing the space show, when I was doing work on my dissertation, and they sponsor the space show, and I love having their guys and gals on the program. And have met a lot of great guests through NSS. They have rich contacts throughout the industry. People, if you're not a member, you should join it. It's Ad Astra's First Rate, and they have very, very good programming that you can access. So Emily and I give you give NSS great plus for you to become a supporter and a partner with them, and they are a sponsor of the Space Show, so I do disclose that. But I'd be saying that even if they weren't a sponsor to the Space Show. Emily, what caught my attention was you were doing a series of blog articles on your blog called Space in the 70s, and then in each one you sort of targeted a topic like the space shuttle, the decade that brought back the human element to space flight, Skylab and other astronomy experiments. How did you come up with this idea for space in the 70s? And tell us a little bit about what you've been saying.
Yeah, well, the thing with in space history, a lot of space history, and this isn't a criticism because there's a lot of wonderful space history books and articles about these periods. So it's not really a criticism as much as I'm just pointing it out. A lot of space history talks about Apollo, the lunar missions, which most of them happened. A lot of that, you know, started in the 60s, got its start in the 60s. Certainly the TESS program got its start in the early 60s. So a lot of space history is focused on, you know, the 1960s, sort of like that space race time, you know. And then there's sort of a gap. Like, it goes from, you know, okay, we're going to talk about, you know, the 60s, the, you know, the race to the moon and all that. And then, you know, and then it goes right to the 1980s, which is the space shuttle years, which, you know, were fantastic and amazing, but, you know, not going to take credit from the space shuttle years. But there's sort of this whole gap when we talk about the 1970s, even though a lot was happening during that, a whole lot was happening during that decade. And I think it was because, you know, the lunar landings ended in 1972, and Skylab started, and Skylab, I think, has always been just horrifically underrated. I think people aren't as interested in it because they weren't going to the moon, and they weren't on the space shuttle either. It wasn't really as, I guess, exciting to a lot of people as, you know, the Apollo lunar missions or the shuttle missions, which were to come in about 8 years or so. And Skylab, if you really dig into it, and you know this, and a lot of, there are people who know this, but I don't think the general public knows this. Skylab is just as amazing as, you know, either of those programs. I mean, it's got, it almost didn't make it to orbit. I mean, it had a lot of problems, and there were quite a few hair-raising moments during that program, and I think it deserves just as much publicity as anything else that happened, you know, during NASA's history. And then we talked, you know, and then, of course, there was Apollo-Soyuz, you know, which also was really a neat moment in history because nobody thought that would ever happen. And then, you know, we had, there were a lot of really cool uncrewed missions as well. I've written about a few of them. You know, you had sort of these telecommunications programs that were pioneering what would happen in the 80s. You know, and obviously we had Viking, we had Voyager. We had all that. So the 70s were really more of a rich time, I think, in spaceflight history than people think. And also they were developing the space shuttle, which in itself was amazing because they've never, whether you like the space shuttle or not, I mean, they've never done anything like that before. They had to invent totally new processes to you know, come up with the space shuttle, which at the time was just the most complex, I think still is the most complex flying machine ever built. So it was really a rich time in space history, and I don't think people really recognize it because there's such a focus on, you know, okay, Apollo lunar missions and then after, which was the space shuttle, and there's sort of this, you know, middle period where, you know, there weren't as much, there weren't any space flights. You know, obviously between 1975 and 1981, there weren't any U.S. space flights. But there was a lot else going on, and the shuttle was also being developed, and I think people just forget about that. And also, there were the approach and landing tests, which were incredible. as well. I mean, I'm amazed that, you know, I look at that stuff and I'm like, I'm amazed that it went off as well as it did because nobody knew what was going to happen. They'd never tested anything like that before. So it's really my attempt to put a era that's sort of underrated in spaceflight history sort of in the forefront. And the article I did about the human, putting the human element back in the spaceflight was really about, you know, during the Apollo era and before the Apollo era, you know, you had Gemini, you had Mercury. You know, astronauts were really seen as, like, these sort of macho men, very, like, stiff upper lip, you know, infallible, you know, just not very emotional and stuff like that. And then in the 70s, you see sort of these glimpses of humanity and these expressions of joy. You know, you see somebody like Ron Evans, you know, at the, on the last Apollo mission doing his spacewalk and just, I mean, he was probably the most happy person ever to a spacewalk ever. You know, and you just see things like that. And, you know, Skylab had moments like that that were really fun. And then you see, you know, Apollo Soyuz was just really joyous because, you know, you've had these rival nations meeting in orbit for the first time. And sort of all those political issues just dissipated. They were just friends up there. And I really wanted to write about that because I think it's important to, you know, remember that, you know, that decade really brought those moments, you know, here. And, you know, it still has resonances for what's going on now, you know. And, you know, the things that we enjoy seeing now as we, you know, get to new eras of space flight. Obviously, we had Inspiration 4 just happen, which was the first non-agency mission, you know. So I don't know. I kind of went off on a tangent here. I really just wanted to write about an era that nobody is writing about. So I don't have any plans solidified yet, but I'm thinking of expanding it into a book maybe. Who knows?
I have a listener email question for you already. Kind of related to the era that you're writing about. This is from Todd in San Diego, California, and he said, I'm curious if in your research of the 70s and our space history, did you come across anything that you could imagine might be a precursor, a link, or an indication of the commercial market that came to exist much later on? Was there any foundation that you found or any possible connection or route to the 70s into what we have today?
Absolutely. There are a lot of precursors to what's going on today. In the 1970s, there was somebody who was a working scientist who became very famous. A lot of you are familiar with him. I've written a lot about him, Gerard K. O'Neill. And he was really one of the first people who predicted that NASA was probably not going to be doing all space flight in the future. That there would be other actors in space flight who would be, you know, sort of, you know, dictating things and doing their own space flight. And, of course, he's also known as the father of space settlement because he came up with his own ideas for, you know, settlements in space, his, you know, habitats and stuff. And if you read The High Frontier, it was published in 1976, you know, and obviously that was 45 years ago, but it really is quite modern. It's still a good read, and it really, to me, is sort of a blueprint of how, you know, how we're going to get to space without NASA. And I do want to make it clear that he did work with NASA, but he was well aware that, you know, NASA wasn't going to be able to fund everything just because, this is still true. NASA's focus changes so much with each political office. So he was well aware that people would have to do it themselves. So that's definitely somebody who sort of saw the writing on the wall as far as 50 years ago, 45 years ago. Also in the 70s, you saw people starting their own kind of rocket companies. You saw people like Robert Truax. I think I got his name right. And you saw in 1979, of course, even though it's more associated with the European Space Agency, the Ariane program got off the ground, and they did a lot of commercial launches as well that weren't necessarily, you know, Space Agency focused. So there were definitely, in that era, there were a lot of precursors to what we're seeing now with, you know, we have a bunch of different actors and a lot of different launch providers that aren't necessarily space agency affiliated. So, yeah.
Did you notice, pick up on any discernible difference in public opinion about space and ventures then as compared to today?
Honestly, I think in the 70s, I think it was around the same almost, because I think once the lunar program, well, let's even take it further back than then. I think once Apollo 11 happened, I think people sort of developed this attitude like, okay, we did it, whatever, you know, they sort of lost interest, which is really sad. And I think around 1970, even people within NASA became aware that, okay, you know, with, you know, we got a lot of budget cuts coming up. We got, you know, we're going to face cancellations of the program. And not only that, but, you know, we're not going to be able to interest the public as much in the program because, you know, we just can't, you know, they were losing, you know, they didn't have the funds. I mean, they just didn't have the kind of marketing that they once had. So I think in the 70s, you know, a lot of people just lost interest in the space program, even though we were doing some pretty spectacular things throughout the decade, you know. Even if we weren't flying humans in space throughout the entire decade, a lot of the, you know, like I said, a lot of the uncrewed programs such as, you know, Voyager did the Grand Tour, which is just still nothing but incredible. I mean, even, you know, in 2021, what Voyager did to me is mind-blowing. I mean, absolutely. And that, you know, that launched in 1977. You know, it shows that technology was robust enough that it's still working, you know. So I think the attitudes, honestly, are very similar to the way they are now, because I think people just, as a whole, aren't just as interested in spaceflight, you know. They sort of take it for granted. They take the fact that we have a lot of spinoffs from space flight for granted. In the 1970s, NASA did start a program called Spinoff, where they would try to discuss applications from space flight that we use on Earth. And it interests, I think, space enthusiasts. It doesn't interest laymen as much or regular people as much, because regular people just kind of take the technology for granted. I mean, you know, I'm holding this itty-bitty phone in my hand, and I'm doing an interview with someone, I think, across the country. That's directly because of spaceflight. And to me, that's nothing but incredible, and we should be, you know, fascinated by it. And I think, you know, I think there are similarities in attitude today as well. You know, like, we had Inspiration 4 happen a few weeks ago, and that should have been, I mean, on the front pages, because it was the first, like I said, non-agency space flight, you know, with non-space agency astronauts on board. And I think space enthusiasts were very excited about it, but you didn't see regular people really get amped about it. I don't even think they knew what was going on. So, yeah, I think the attitudes are very similar between now and then.
You have a caller waiting to talk to you. Hi, caller. Welcome.
Okay.
Welcome to the program. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall.
Hi, Marshall.
Oklahoma. And you've just hit what I was going to ask about. The people, earlier you were talking about people being particularly happy and inspired by people in space looking like they were enjoying themselves. And Inspiration 4 seems to have done the same thing, but as you were starting to point out, it doesn't seem to have the same impact. Any idea why?
I think, I don't want to get in trouble, I'm trying to choose my words very carefully. I think just because, you know, we have the 24-hour news cycle, you know, we hear news all the time, I just think it got drowned out probably by whatever else was happening in the news cycle around that time. And I think in the 70s, we were seeing sort of the dawning of the 24-hour news cycle. You know, sort of the embryonic, I guess, the embryonic dawning of that thing. You know, in the 80s, I think it really started to take off, and in the 90s, it just took hold. And I think it got sort of lost in the shuffle, unfortunately. I think it's sad because I think it deserved a lot more attention than it got because, I mean, it's a really big deal. I mean, these are, it's showing that, you know, people who aren't naturally trained astronauts, you know, can go to space. You don't have to be like this superhuman superhero to go to space. Not to say that they weren't trained to go to space. I think the crew on Inspiration 4 was very well prepared. I think they were very professional, and they were probably more than capable of, you know, going to space on a NASA mission. I believe that, but they weren't. You know, they weren't affiliated with the space agency, and I can't emphasize what a big deal that is. You know, so I am disappointed that it didn't get more publicity in the 24-hour news cycle, but I think it's part of, you know, that is that, you know, I'm not really blaming the media. I'm just blaming how news works nowadays. You know, it's a lot, you know, you got so much happening and so many headlines and things just sort of get shuffled, you know, due to priority, and it probably just wasn't up there, if that makes sense.
I would come in there and say the political news kind of drowned out a lot of it. And I think that's the real problem, is technical accomplishments are, what would you call, downgraded in the presence of political stuff. So
I would add to that, Marshall, because when I did the CNN thing, both on the original Branson flight and then the Blue Origin flight, and then I did another CNN thing for 7 Minutes of Glory for the Inspiration flight, and all of the questions were naysayers and negatives. I've talked about this on the show before. And a lot of the articles that appeared were criticism of billionaires spending their money this way. And others were how rockets are destroying the environment and how we can't turn space over to these kinds of people. And they got lots and lots of headline time, which was not the case way back when in the 70s. So the high quality part, the inspiration part, you know, the importance of what all of this signifies, got lost for publications more willing to, and I don't want to say politically correct because that's not really accurate, but more willing to go down the how dare you billionaires do this road, which I find is really short-sighted and vile and disgusting and dishonest. But I think that was a pretty heavy factor and might have impacted what you're asking about, Marshall.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We both totally agree. So I'll let somebody else talk.
Thank you, Marshall.
Bye. Thank you.
I've never talked to you about all the naysayer stuff, but it really pisses me off, and I shouldn't let it bother me, but it's such a lie. And that the CNN people, it's so dishonest, and it's so dishonest to the people to try to influence the people into this what I call an economy of scarcity rather than an economy of innovation and excitement and creativity and solving problems by opening up access. It's probably criminal at some level, but good luck in getting that one prosecuted. But
I agree with you. I see when I go on like Twitter, I know I'm probably getting off a tangent.
Right.
When I go on like Twitter and stuff like that, I'm a big fan of Gerard K. O'Neill, which is kind of weird because a lot of people think that's odd because a lot of his stuff, you know, came to light well before I was alive. But I read The High Frontier and I just fell in love with it. I just was like, this guy makes a lot of sense. And when I first, started reading it, I was like, this is nuts. I mean, I honestly believe what probably everybody else thought, you know, okay, this guy's talking about living in space, that's crazy. But when I read the book, I realized it was a powerful treatise on getting, you know, making space accessible for all people. I realized that I sort of misunderstood what he was about, you know. And I'm a really big fan of, I'm a huge fan of what he has to say. And I go to Twitter, and a lot of people just completely understand, like, his ideas. Even some, and I'm probably going to start a firestorm by saying this, I think even some of his followers misunderstand his ideas. You know, I really think, you know, this was somebody who was just very ahead of his time, very futuristic, and he saw the writing on the wall. He saw that we're going to have to do it ourselves. We can't rely on a space agency to do it. You know, so I'm really, that's what I'm about nowadays. I'm really interested in getting that word out that, okay, it doesn't have to be NASA. It doesn't have to be like, Not to poo-poo NASA or say anything bad about them. I'm a huge fan of NASA. Yeah, you know, not to, you know, pass judgment on them or anything, but, you know, we don't have to be with this great big space agency or this government entity to make it happen.
What were some of the, you wrote a one of your articles on astronomy experiments on Skylab. Talk to us a little bit about what went on Skylab. What makes it such a special mission other than the fact that it exists?
Wow. Skylab was incredible. I honestly don't think anybody, a lot of people, give it a lot of what it deserves. Skylab was really the first platform in orbit for science. And it really focused on three areas, specific areas of science. It focused on medical science, it focused on solar physics, and it focused on Earth studies. But it also had a ton of other experiments as well. It had all the student-led experiments, and it also had, I recently just wrote that article that you just mentioned, it had a suite of astronomy experiments. A few of them were in ultraviolet. One of them was an X-ray experiment. And it really, for its time, was Skylab was very versatile. It had a lot of uses. It was doing an awful lot to try to figure out, what is the sun actually doing? You know, let's get some actual good pictures of the sun and try to, you know, predict its behavior. That really, there had been solar observatories up until that time, but they weren't very powerful. And Skylab had a tremendous capability. I mean, like an unlimited capability. And that was a really big deal at the time. And also, you know, it mapped, it did a lot of, not mapping, but it took a lot of pictures of the Earth, which helped to augment the Landsat program, which is not a very glamorous program, but I think in 100 years, we're going to see that Landsat is one of those programs that we just needed the most, because it really is going to be a big predictor of, okay, what's happening to our Earth, you know, what's happening to our resources on Earth. So, and also there were medical experiments on board. They were among the first to figure out that, hey, you get taller in space, you know, hey, there are changes in, you know, your bone mass, and there's changes in your blood while you're in space, and, you know, things like that. And Skylab is really the direct precursor to the International Space Station. Because it was our only space station that we had before the ISS. And a lot of people do not think about that. They think of Skylab, oh, it was from the 70s, and it's old and stuff, and blah, blah, blah. You know, and you see comments on YouTube under videos like, oh, Skylab was kind of a joke and stuff, but they really did so much to advance, you know, to advance those areas in the early 70s. And a lot of people just do not realize it. And it was very special. And they kept all the data from Skylab, and a lot of that data really helped with the current International Space Station program, which is orbiting above us right now. So, yeah. So, Skylab, like I said, there's also other things in the Skylab program that a lot of people don't think about. The manned maneuvering unit was tested on there. You know, everybody's seen the poster, right, of Bruce McCandless flying in space on the MMU. Well, that was tested in Skylab. You know, I mean, really, it's just, to me, Skylab was always just the bridge between Apollo and the space shuttle. because it really taught people, okay, you know, we went to the moon, you know, for a few days. That was really cool, but now we have to figure out how are we going to live in space? You know, how are we going to make this a thing? And that's what Skylab did. It really pioneered that, and I wish more people realized that. So I hope that answered the question.
I have a caller on hold, but also Jane in Seattle sent in a short note, and she says, I seem to recall it was very controversial to deorbit Skylab. Do you think that it could have been saved?
Thank you, Jane. That's a great question. Unfortunately, I do not think it could have been saved at the time, and there were a few factors contributing to that. What happened was Skylab was supposed to stay in orbit until 1983, and then that got changed to 1980 because the sun was reaching solar maximum. And basically what happened was the Earth's atmosphere started to swell, which caused Skylab to begin to come back to deorbit. So by the end of 1978, NASA knew they weren't going to be able to save it, unfortunately. And NASA wanted to do a Skylab reboot mission using the space shuttle, and it actually had a crew and everything. The crew was supposed to be Fred Hayes and Jack Lausma, but unfortunately the shuttle was just not ready yet. As we know, the shuttle didn't fly until 1981, so they had a few holdups with the shuttle. So as much as I would have liked to have seen a Skylab stay up, it was just not meant to be, unfortunately.
You know, we've covered that, Jane, on many older space shuttle programs. You could probably use our search box and look for Skylab, and you might find those older programs where that was actually covered in detail. Let's see who your caller is. Hi, caller, and welcome to the program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth.
Hi, John. Welcome to the show again.
Yeah, the 70s, I think one thing I've kind of thought about the subject is that perhaps we kind of got a little bit too much enthusiasm after the success of Apollo, and we're a little bit enthusiastic to go straight to something like the shuttle. It might be kind of to actually make that as viable as something like that should be. We just really didn't quite have the maturity yet, and we probably maybe should have just continued using the Apollo era equipment, you know, to do various space missions in the 70s, and maybe worked on some kind of subscale unmanned demonstrator of a you know, reentry craft that could land on an airfield or something, but you know, but mainly not operational. But you know, we could have used Apollo capsules and continued like Skylab and other things. In other words, they quit making that equipment, but maybe they should have continued to make that equipment for a few more years.
Your viewpoint is it's actually shared by a lot of people who worked at NASA at the time. I've talked to a few astronauts from that era, and there are two of them I know specifically, and they're not with us anymore, unfortunately, but they agreed completely, with your assessment. They honestly felt, you know, NASA should have been, there was no reason NASA shouldn't have kept on using the Saturn 1B and the Saturn 5s because those rockets were actually really, I wouldn't say safe, but they had a really good, you know, they had a pretty decent safety record. They didn't have many failures. The Saturn V was basically, you could lose an engine and you could still be fine. You could still get to orbit. Whereas the space shuttle, you could not, if you lost an engine, you were in trouble. So a lot of astronauts actually agree with that assessment, and they wish that the Saturns would have kept flying, and they wish, you know, we got a Skylab B right now sitting in the Smithsonian, and that was canceled. It never flew. And there was one astronaut, Dr. Phil Chapman, who was supposed to fly it, and he did end up resigning NASA because he honestly did not want to fly the space shuttle because he saw the writing on the wall. He saw that there were design issues with it that result in a loss of crew, and he was absolutely right.
And he's no longer with us either. He passed away, I think,
yeah,
a year or two ago. But, you know, we have three Saturn V's that were ready to fly that are now in museums.
Yeah. I agree. I love the space shuttle. I love reading about its developments, but I do agree with you. There was, I think the Saturn V and I think the Saturn I, they were safer than the space shuttle. As much as I love the space shuttle, there were design compromises made with it, which did end up resulting in crew losses. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, I think on that, like I said, I think the concept of a space shuttle, I'm 100% supportive of the idea, but I just think it was done before its time with too little budget and probably not enough, demonstration and validation work ahead of time. We just kind of plunged into this is going to be our whole space transportation system, you know, and totally committed to it, and then we ended up having to go back to, you know, unmanned rocket launchers for a lot of satellites and stuff because of the Challenger disaster. And it seems to me like that I like those kind of vehicles. I just kind of think we pushed it ahead of time without enough budget and commitment, and we could have, you know, done something else in the meantime. And maybe the 90s or so went on to developing something like the shuttle at that point, you know, because you would have had more maturity if you'd done some subscale experimental vehicles and things, you know. Well, yeah. Of course, the other disaster was, of course, the Russians' complete failure to get to the moon, I think, really held NASA back, I think. If the Russians had got to the moon, say, subsequent to Apollo 11, I have a feeling there'd have been an ongoing kind of competition along, well, they did this, but we did it better, and you know what I mean? They would have been much more interested in funding space. With them totally failing on that area, you know, I think we just said, okay, we've won. Check up your feet, like you're saying, and relax.
Yes. And I think part of it, too, was after Apollo 13, and I think just the, you know, the general riskiness of moon missions themselves, even though I do want to emphasize that the launchers, the launch systems were actually pretty robust. I think Apollo 13, you know, obviously freaked, you know, politicians out enough that they were like, okay, you know, we want to do something, you know, we want to wrap up Apollo, you know, the lunar missions, and do something different. And the shuttle was being sold, you know, as being sort of it would be like an airline. You know, it would be like this low-cost alternative. It was reusable. And, you know, as much as I love the space shuttle, I love it. I'm not, it didn't end up being any of those things. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, now you're getting to something I've been notorious for on the space show, is claiming that basically the Apollo 13, after that, the political people, more than NASA, the presidential level and right below, were saying, hey, you know, we've won the space race. Let's get out of this before we have an embarrassing disaster up there that'll, you know, and that's probably why they didn't fly the last three Apollos, among other reasons, was the moon, because, you know, but they had to do a few more to show we weren't too scared to do it, but then after that, let's get out of this. I think that's what the political sector was thinking.
Yeah, there was a lot. There was a lot going on at that point that was just, you know, I do agree with you, though. I there's that part of me that, you know, looks back at, you know, and, you know, that part of me that wishes, you know, the alternate history part of me that wishes, you know, maybe we should have flown Saturn V and Saturn I's, and we just should have had sort of infrastructure in space, you know, sort of more advanced Skylab programs. And, you know, we could have still kept flying the Apollo hardware, but we could have also, you know, in the 70s, we could have done what the Soviets were doing in the 70s, you know, and, you know, seeing how people lived in space for long durations and things like that. So I do agree with you.
Okay. Well, I'll clear a line for the next caller then.
Thank you very much, John.
Okay, right.
Listeners, there's still time if you also would like to either email us or give us a call for today. So email is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. You can call and talk to Emily at 866-687-7223. One of your articles that I really liked, it's actually the most recent one, was Disco Delays and Disillusionment, Bruce McCandless and Al Warden during the 70s. Your title, Disco Delays and Disillusionment. You gotta tell us a little bit about this one. This is October 9th.
Yeah, I just published this.
You just did it, yeah.
There's two books out. One of them is just being released, I think, in the next few weeks, and one of them's been out for a couple months. There's a book called Wonders All Around, and it was written by Bruce McCandless III, who is Bruce McCandless II's son. And then there's The Light of Earth, which was written by Al Warden and Francis French. And both books, they cover a lot more than just the 1970s, but both books sort of cover the period of that, you know, in that decade where both men were really disillusioned. What had happened to McCandless was he hadn't been selected for a space flight. He didn't fly during Apollo or Skylab, so he was sort of in this, you know, astronaut purgatory where he's like, okay, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to fly during shuttles? And then this newspaper article comes out about him that basically portrays him as like a forgotten astronaut. And it was very distressing to him, understandably. And so he was really going through the 70s sort of with this feeling like, you know, am I going to ever fly? And Al Warden, who did fly in 1971 during Apollo 15, he was caught up in the Apollo 15, the SAMP scandal. And even though if you read Falling to Earth, that really tells the truth about what actually happened during that. And, you know, he was also sort of an astronaut purgatory. He was exiled to NASA Ames. You know, he wasn't going to fly again. And his reputation was, you know, really tainted from that. And he would have liked to have flown again. I don't think he was a fan of the space shuttle, but I think if he had had the chance, he would have flown on it. So the article really deals with what both of those astronauts were dealing with during that decade of just sort of, okay, I'm stuck. You know? I'm stuck. And fortunately, both stories have a happy ending. You know, Al eventually, you know, he does, you know, work again in sort of the aerospace field, doing private business. And McCandless, of course, becomes one of the most famous astronauts of all time. You know, he's the guy in the MMU, and he's in that incredible photo. And he also helped to deploy the Hubble Space Telescope. So it's sort of a capsule history and a review of both those books, which are new books, and they're fantastic. Y'all can go buy them. Yeah.
What is the role of Disco?
Disco? It was the 70s. it went with the theme.
I know we're doing only an hour program, and I can't believe that time is almost up. Tell us a little bit about you have a podcast now in addition to your blog. Is that correct?
Yeah, I have a couple things. Other than I'm very busy right now, which is great. I like being busy. I have a podcast called Space and Things with a great friend of mine, my co-host Dave Giles. He's a musician, he lives in London, and he's a huge space enthusiast. And we have a show once a week, and usually we have a guest on. Our last guest was guests were Eileen Collins and Jonathan Ward, who are putting out a new book. We have usually guests every week, and we've interviewed a lot of amazing people in the space program. So, yeah, check your favorite podcast provider. We should be on all of them, and it's called Space and Things, and we do have a website called spaceandthingspodcast.com. Right now, I know you're familiar with this company. I'm doing a series of guest blogs for Celestis Memorial Space Flight.
Right, their sponsor too, yeah.
Yeah, I've done a couple blogs. I did one about Phil Chapman, and I did one about Bill Pogue. So, yeah, and I'm going to do some more.
And both of those were multiple guests on the space show years and years ago. Phil was a very, very close friend, and he's a big loss. You actually have another caller waiting, so let's take it. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Tim from Huntsville.
Hi, Tim.
Yeah, and speaking of alternate history, how about this one? Let's say Elon Musk decided not to start SpaceX or to build his Falcon 9, right? But instead, Robert Turek got to build the Sea Dragon. How would that change everything?
Oh God, Well, if you watch the it's a great alternate history TV show that's out. It's on Apple TV. It's called For All Mankind. I love it. They actually use the Sea Dragon on that show as like a cargo vessel to send in, you know, to send all sorts of stuff to the moon, like, you know, infrastructure, cargo, food, et cetera, you know, logistics. It's a logistics vehicle. So if the Sea Dragon had flown, I would like to see it as that kind of vehicle, you know, if we had actually established a habitat on the moon or perhaps somewhere else, you know, the, in deep space. So, yeah, that if you haven't watched For All Mankind yet, it's worth it if only for the Sea Dragon part. It's really cool. The launches are amazing. So, yeah, I would check it out. But, yeah, I'd like to think that it would have that kind of purpose for cargo, large cargo.
Tim, you missed Truax's son on the show.
I know. I just remembered it as your show was going off.
So, and he talked. He had a lot to say about Sea Dragon. So you might want to listen it. And he just said there was no market. Nobody wanted it. They wouldn't touch it. So, very, he's a very interesting guy, Scott Truax. And he has a book about actually Evel Knievel jumping the Snake River with his dad. And then, of course, also in his rocket business, his father wrote a bio that never got finished before he died. So he finished it and then published the auto bio of his father, Robert Truax.
Yeah. I imagine there wouldn't be a market unless you were doing something on akin to what Gerald K. O'Neill wanted to do, which is build a large, giant space colony to be at Lagrange Point. I could actually see it being used for something like that.
Would have had to have a lot of vision back then, but boy, I try to sell that in a market study or something that they might have used, and I think it would have petered out before it even got going. But
yeah.
If I can borrow a minute from Emily, are you familiar with a group out of Huntsville called Space Nukes?
Space Nukes? No, I'm not, and I'm embarrassed to admit that I am not.
What about you, Tim, since you're headquartered in Huntsville?
This is the first time I'm hearing about it.
Okay, go to Space Nukes. Not now. Do it on your own. It's the Space Nuclear Power Corp. Space Nukes, SpaceNukes.com. And I have open lines next week, so you can check it out on open lines next week, okay? What the hell is that noise? Is that you?
No, that's not me.
Emily, is that you?
That's not me.
Well, I don't know what the... Oh, I opened his website. Oh, then it's playing, it's playing the music through his website. Tim, I don't want to borrow too much time from Emily, but give us your thought on the people. It looks to me like at the moment it's all vaporware, but it's got a lot of people involved, and it's got kilopower people from NASA involved, and just... Call us on open lines, okay?
All right, I'll try to remember that. I keep forgetting to.
Well, don't. Put a string around your damn finger. Come on, you can remember. SpaceNukes.com.
I'll definitely check out that site. Besides, I'm actually the vice president for our local NFS chapter, and we actually have a monthly meeting. So you just gave me an idea for hosting someone for one of our monthly webinars.
Yeah, they've got three people listed in the company that, you know, I've heard of David Poston. I haven't heard of the other two, but just check it out. Again, I don't want to steal time from Emily's show, but.
Will do.
Okay. Tim, anything else that you wanted to call relevant to Emily being our guest today?
No, that's about it.
Okay. Thank you, Tim, for your call.
You're welcome.
Emily, where else are your articles? Are they only on NSS, or can people find other parts of your work elsewhere? Where do we find all of what you're doing?
Pieces that I mentioned for Celestis are on the Celestis website, blogs I do for the NSS are on the NSS website. I also have a blog on Medium. It deals more with, like, sort of women's issues in aerospace. And that is called The Making of an X-Nuke.
Of an X what?
Nuke, N-U-K-E.
Okay. That's
so,
that's you, correct? You're from nuclear power days in the summer,
yep.
In the Navy, right?
That's me. So, so yeah, I do have that blog as well. So, yeah, and of course I do have we do have the podcast, which is at faithandthingspodcast.com.
Okay, and you have a caller on hold, but first I like to give credit where credit is due, and I found out about the Huntsville nuke guy from John Jossi, who provides a lot of great information to the space show and companies and information on guests, and that came from him earlier this morning. And you have another caller waiting to hear from you, so let's see who's on the call. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, David. This is John in Fremont. Thanks for the credit.
Speak of the devil. Welcome to the show again. How are you?
Good. Hey, Emily. I really appreciate your blog post on the National Space Society blog. And so I wanted to circle back to Gerard K. O'Neill. And
circle back? Oh, my God. Don't tell me you're adopting that term.
Please,
John, please. We're all going to circle back now to the 70s.
I don't know.
Go ahead.
It's just kind of programmed in my brain. So, you know, the High Frontier talked a lot about, I mean, it's right in the shuttle era. And so, you know, Gerry O'Neill was, you know, thinking that there would be multiple shuttle flights to build these space colonies, and you know, it was just not the right time. I have so many questions. I don't know where to start. You know, the shuttle originally had a reusable first stage and had to be scaled back just because they were cutting costs. But I wonder, you know, if it would have been a little bit more successful if it was fully reusable. But I guess that technology just was not ready.
Yeah, I don't think...
I'm just making a comment.
Go ahead, Emily.
Did I interrupt you? I hope I did.
No, I don't think so, but you were going to say something.
Yeah, I don't... Like I said, I think the shuttle was a design compromise, basically. I would get in further into it, but we'd be here forever. But it was basically a design compromise, you know. Like you said, they could have had, you know, a reusable first stage type one, but I think that would have taken even longer to develop than, you know, than it actually did. And I think a criticism that's offered of O'Neill's work from that time is that, you know, he didn't rely a lot on, okay, we're going to have the space shuttle. But I don't think O'Neill or really anybody at that time could have been fully aware that, you know, the shuttle was just not going to be what it was advertised as being. I mean, in the you know, I remember I read one of the old Gaines books. Some of you will remember those from back in the day. And it had this, you know, or the Observer spaceflight book. And it predicted that, you know, oh, yeah, we're going to have a space shuttle flight every 2 weeks, and we're going to have 500 flights by, you know, 1992.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
And that was a real prediction, and obviously that didn't happen. I honestly believe, you know, it was being sold as like an airliner, and it was never going to be like that.
Yeah. And also, you know, the High Frontier was looking at space solar power as the driving force behind space colonies, and that was ahead of its time, too. You know, he saw that global warming would be a problem. But since we're talking about alternative histories, do you think he'd have a better chance nowadays than before? Because ground-based solar and wind weren't really even possible back then. And so, I mean, there's so many things are possible, you know?
I think if he came out nowadays, I think he would probably have a, maybe, I think, I don't know if he would be as popular as he was in the 1970s, but I think he would have a better chance of being, like, taken seriously, if that makes any sense. Because I think he was a little ahead of his time, which, unfortunately, I think he was so futuristic that just some people were like, okay, this is a bunch of, you know, I think when he went and talked to Congress, he was so futuristic that he sort of talked himself out of opportunities there, which, you know, isn't really a criticism of him as much as, you know, he was thinking very big and other people were thinking way too small. So, yeah.
Yeah, and another thing that happened in the 70s was the merging of the L5 Society with that other organization to create NSS, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the L5 Society started in 1975, and eventually it merged with the NSS in 1987, with the NSI in 1987, and now it's called the modern-day NSS.
Okay, that happened a decade later. I got that mixed up. I was thinking, I guess, I got it mixed up with the formation of the L5 Society. But the Space Studies Institute was formed back then.
Yeah, that was formed in 1977.
Yeah. All right, well, boy, nostalgia, good times.
Yes.
John, one thing I have realized in 20 years of the space show, if you were an original L5er and not an original NSSer, you make sure that everybody knows that. You put it in your signature. You plaster it everywhere, L5. People hold on to that designation come hell or high water, and they want you to know that they date from and were part of L5. And, boy, do they hold on to that. I've noticed that for years and years and years doing the space show. So
it's a badge of honor.
Absolutely. It has not gone away, that's for sure. Anything else, John?
No, that's it. Thank you very much, Emily.
By the way, let's listen next week. We'll see what Tim says about that organization you found out called Space Nukes.
Yeah, and they're speaking at the Mars Society conference.
Okay.
So Poston or whatever.
Yeah, David
Poston. Chief Technology Officer is going to speak there. So.
Okay. Thanks a lot, John. Appreciate it.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Emily, I have another email for you. It's got a subject line title, Space Flight Indifference, and it's from Adrian in San Diego. We must face reality in that likely never again will the masses be captured in their imagination by space flight, and if any fraction of humanity is destined for exploring and living in space, it should just count on the willing. The masses see billionaires going into space, but they are mainly concerned with finding enough toilet paper or how they can afford the mortgage or rent for a place to live. The Musk and maybe the Bezos will probably get us there, so just work hard on getting your finances in order for that high-priced fare to Mars or to a Luna base, Shackleton. And for the rest, well, I hope Gaia will take care of them. Adrian. So there's a good predictive for the future.
Yeah.
Comments to Adrian?
I don't know. I'm hoping that, you know, space will become more accessible to regular people as time goes on, you know, and I don't know. I'm trying to remain optimistic.
Yeah, I totally understand where Adrian is coming from, but I would like to think that somehow we overcome, you know, that outcome. Would I bet money on it? Let's say this, now that I'm 75, would I put my retirement fund into betting on the opposite of what he's talking about? No, I would not.
Yeah.
I would put my retirement fund probably in a mattress given the way things are going. So
I don't
think the new legislation can track what my mattress does with my money. So, you know, maybe, you know, that's an advantage to have it in a mattress. I don't know. The mattress doesn't report. So what can I say? I know we're over the 60 minutes, and we could spend two or three space shows talking about many of these topics and stuff. Have we missed something that you wanted to talk with us about or tell us about what you're doing, or maybe point us toward another article or two that you're doing? Or can we subscribe to your NSS blog, or do you only get it by checking it out?
Yes, you can subscribe to the NSS blog, and you'll not only get my pieces, but you'll also get all the other NSS pieces as well. So
okay.
Definitely subscribe to it.
Okay, you have another caller. Can you stay to take the call?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, David. David, this is Gene in Pasadena.
Okay, here's another optimistic one for you.
thank you.
This is.
You kind of touched on this a little bit. Your previous one or two callers did. I remember that back in the middle 70s or late 70s, NASA actually funded some studies from Northrop Grumman and General Dynamics and Boeing and a couple of others on. Not just on space-based solar power, but building facilities on the moon that would manufacture these things and launch it back towards the Earth. And that was all done, as they say, in the middle and sort of late 70s, maybe 78, 79. Do you touch on that in any of your writings?
Yes. I know NASA, there were three summer studies at NASA Ames, 75, 76, 77. Which I believe were chaired by O'Neill, and I have touched a little bit upon it in my my blog, just because I've written a lot about O'Neill. So I've touched a bit on that, and what's fascinating is some of the recordings from the 76 session are on SoundCloud, on the SSI channel, and they're incredible to listen to. It is like a time capsule, because they're in perfect, They sound perfect. I mean, it's amazing. So if you're into that, definitely listen to it.
Yeah, I will. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. All right,
thank
I know
you.
It's late in the show, so thanks, David, for taking my call.
Okay, thank you, Gene, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Any summary, any concluding comments, anything you'd like to leave us for the day?
No, basically, thank you for appreciating. I'm glad you appreciate my Space in the 70s blog, because sometimes when I write them, I'm like, is anybody reading this?
Yeah, no,
I
think they're reading them. At least I read them and found them and was interested in them. So hopefully I'm not that unique. So
no, I'm very happy you like them a lot. That makes me feel really, really good, because I'm really glad people are reading them, because I'm hoping maybe they'll expand it into a book eventually. We'll see.
Are you traveling to conferences, or are you still sort of staying around due to COVID? Or I know there's a few conferences where you can go to things in person, but have you started going out in public to space events yet?
Yeah, this summer I actually went to Space Fest, and I did a couple panels there, and I actually did moderated a space shuttle panel at the EAA Air Venture in Wisconsin. So I am starting to do conferences again.
Well, if I start, maybe we'll get to meet in person at one of these events. So
absolutely, would love to.
Well, stay in touch, and I'm sure we'll talk again down the road, and keep up the great work with your writing, and thank you for returning to the Space Show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank
okay.
you. And all right.
All right. And listeners, that's it for Emily today. The weekend is still young, so enjoy it, and stay safe and stay well. And as we like to say, keep looking up. And by the way, there are some very interesting moon, or I should say lunar configurations for the next couple of days in the evening, if you have clear sky, involving Venus, Saturn, and Jupiter on different days and different times, and our moon. So you will see some interesting things if you look up in the sky as we're getting dark, and hopefully you'll have clear skies and you can do that. Again, a full week coming up on the Space Show minus Hotel Mars due to travels for John Batchelor. And a call in next Sunday for open lines. We certainly want to hear from you. And goodbye from Emily, David, and the Space Show. And once again, do keep looking up, especially check out the Moon, Venus, Saturn, and Jupiter over the next couple of days. That's it from the Space Show.